This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Coming up.
Hey, people, shame on you!
President Biden speaks up about the protest on campuses across the nation.
There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
Arizona repeals a Civil War era abortion ban.
It's a victory for women.
In the Kaleidoscope with Allison Keyes segment, a nonprofit advocacy group on free speech.
You are going to have to go through life in our democracy hearing things you don't like.
I'm Allison Keyes in Washington. On campuses across the nation, from George Washington University in the nation's capital to UCLA in California, students turned out to demonstrate against the Israel-Hamas war. Some pro-Palestinian demanding a ceasefire and making accusations of genocide, and others pro-Israeli calling for the release of hostages and accusing counter-protesters of anti-Semitism. Police moved in, sometimes after a delay, as you hear at Columbia in New York.
Let's deploy a flashback!
Thousands of students, professors, and some others have been arrested. President Biden was silent until Thursday.
Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest.
This student at UCLA says.
People being feeling unsafe on both sides.
CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti.
Protesters with makeshift armor ran from the Portland State University Library into dozens of police surrounding the area as officers cleared out a days-long occupation Thursday. Outside, tense clashes as authorities threw protesters to the ground and arrested several. At one point, a car drove into a group who pelted it with objects before the driver sprayed something out the window and ran away. Cleanup on UCLA's campus after chaos erupted early Thursday when officers in riot gear tore down the protester encampment.
They were shooting flash grenades over the heads of these students.
Associate Professor Graham Blair was among the 210 people arrested.
They violently threw protesters from inside the encampment to outside the encampment, and I saw bodies flying through the air. There's no other way to describe it.
In New York, newly released police body camera footage shows officers at Columbia University cutting their way through barricades after the school called in the NYPD to clear protesters from the campus. The NYPD tells CBS News that during that sweep, an officer accidentally fired their gun inside the hall Tuesday, but no one was injured.
When nonviolent protest is met with violent repression, it really does move public opinion and even voting behavior.
Omar Wasu has studied the impact of protests for about 20 years.
If the police use heavy-handed tactics, it sort of ignites a larger movement. At the same time, when protesters are perceived to use extreme tactics, that can lead to both disapproval and legitimize the more forceful response by the police.
And several universities say it is bad actors that are intentionally sparking the violence. Back here at UCLA, we do not know all of the identities of the 210 people that were arrested, but many of them were students and in some cases, faculty members. John Vigliotti, CBS News, Los Angeles.
CBS's Lilia Luciano was at Columbia when police stormed that campus, and we asked whether outside agitators were leading the protest or whether they were run by students.
That is what I saw inside the campus. I went to the encampment, tried to talk to people. There is a whole organization and order of, like, these are the people who speak. The faculty members wear vests, so they're identified as faculty members. There's a set of rules. There is a schedule. There are prayers. There are so many things that are very much organized by the students and in order in the encampment. And because we have this limited access and because anybody can show up on the street, it's all kind of conflated together. So there's been this idea that outside agitators are infiltrating or exploiting the student protesters. And one thing that I keep thinking about and considering is these are Ivy League students. This is one of the best rated universities in the country and in the world. These students, they have been organizing this from the beginning. They know what they stand for, what they're protesting, the set of demands that they are asking their university. There have been negotiations with the university. And so the idea that somebody could come and infiltrate and manipulate these students' minds is questionable. On the other hand, there's also protests, and historically, protests have a process. They have different and determined roles. There are people and there are timelines and there are methods of escalation. And when students gather to protest, what I'm hearing from the students is, yes, we reached out to people who have experience in other protests and consulted with them to determine what the steps are going to be to have our demands met. So that is one sector of what could be regarded as outside agitators. On the other hand, there were people arrested who are known to police, who are anarchists, or who are people who have been arrested multiple times, or people who have, against whom there is evidence of embracing either hateful or straight language and expressions that could be seen as embracing terrorism. Those people, the big question that I kept trying to ask Mayor Eric Adams is, where were they arrested? Because, again, there are protesters outside of the campus. There are protesters inside of the campus. When I went to CCNY, they had arrested a lot of people. There were buses filled with protesters when I got there. Buses. People who were zip-tied, identified by police, processed. Those buses were taken away. Those people were arrested outside before the police came into the campus. But when the numbers come out, they're grouping the people outside and the people inside as being part of this protest.
I'm going to ask you really quickly because I'm running a little short on time. I just want to know, from the students you talked to, are people from both sides afraid? I mean, in other words, are both Jewish people and Arab and Palestinian people afraid and feeling unsafe on campus, or is only one group feeling that way?
Both groups, from what I've heard, are feeling unsafe. Students of color and students of Arab descent, or students who are Muslim, or anybody who has had experiences with police in the past and who are part of the protests, feel that the policing, that the presence of police is a direct threat to them on campus. I've heard from Jewish students who say, not only do the chants and the things that are expressed as part of the protest inside of the campus, but, you know, the presence of protesters outside who we don't know who they are, all of that is a threat to us.
CBS's Lilia Luciano. Coming up, big abortion law changes this week. That's next on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Every day, our world gets a little more connected, but a little further apart. But then, there are moments that remind us to be more human.
Thank you for calling Amica Insurance.
Hey, I was just in an accident.
Don't worry, we'll get you taken care of.
At Amica, We understand that looking out for each other isn't new or groundbreaking. It's human. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Allison Keyes. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs signed a bill on Thursday repealing a Civil War era ban on most abortions. Two Republicans joined Democrats in an emotional vote. CBS's Janet Shamlian.
By your votes of 16 ayes, 14 nays, you have passed House Bill 2677.
After a heated session in the Arizona Capitol, the state's Republican-controlled Senate narrowly voted to repeal an 1864 law that bans almost all abortions. Two Republican senators joined 14 Democrats to reverse the law after the repeal barely cleared the state House last week. The Civil War-era law predates Arizona's statehood. It bans all abortions except if the mother's life is in danger and could allow the state to prosecute abortion providers. The decision divided voters in the battleground state.
It's a victory for women. It's a victory for the Constitution.
The repeal allows the state's 15-week abortion limit, enacted before Roe v. Wade was overturned, to remain state law.
We still have a road ahead of us.
The repeal will not take effect until 90 days after the legislative session ends. With the near total ban set to take effect June 27th, there will likely be a near total ban on abortions in Arizona for a period of weeks or months this summer.
The thing that I worry about most is what are we going to do in that gap time when abortion is going to be illegal in Arizona?
Janet Shamlian, CBS News, Phoenix.
Now to Florida, where a ban on abortions took effect.
Once a refuge for patients seeking abortion services in the South, the state's new six-week ban has just begun.
6 weeks is very, very early in pregnancy. It's 2 weeks past a missed period.
Florida now joining 12 other states with total or near-total bans. Campaigning on the issue in Jacksonville, Vice President Kamala Harris blamed the new law on former President Trump.
Donald Trump handpicked three members of the United States Supreme Court because he intended for them to overturn Roe.
Trump on the trail in Michigan.
The states now decide on abortion, and you go to the states, and the states come out, and they decide, which is what everybody wanted.
Come November, voters in a number of states, including Florida, are set to vote on the permanent role of abortion access in the state's constitutions. Jared Hill, CBS News.
The IRS is stepping up its efforts to crack down on tax cheats. CBS's Jason Brooks.
Thanks to $80 billion in new federal government funding under the Inflation Reduction Act, the Internal Revenue Service has hired more investigators in order to speed up the processing of tax returns as well as perform more audits. The IRS says it's been underfunded for years, leading to a drop-off in audit rates, but it says its ramped-up enforcement helped it collect $520 million from wealthy taxpayers who hadn't filed their taxes or still owed money from previous years. While it plans a sharp increase in audits in the coming years, the IRS says it will focus on people making more than $400,000 a year.
The FBI says scammers are targeting the nation's seniors, and complaints by elderly victims rose 14% last year. Total losses to those over the age of 60 jumped by 11%. CBS's Nicole Skanga explains.
All of a sudden,
Reverend Malcolm Frazier was browsing his computer when the screen froze.
A message jumped out, said, "Do not turn off your computer. Please call this number."
A scammer persuaded him to transfer tens of thousands of dollars in savings or lose it all.
You thought you were talking to the bank and you were talking to a scammer.
Exactly.
It's called elder fraud crime, and Americans over the age of 60 are now falling victim at record numbers.
Financial fraud is definitely on the rise, and particularly targeting our elderly population.
Last year, $3.4 billion was stolen, according to a newly released FBI report, with more than 100,000 complaints filed to federal law enforcement last year alone, driven by criminal networks operating in West Africa and Asia.
Organized networks of individuals who are well-financed, well-resourced, and are using technology.
Still, experts say the crime targeting seniors is grossly underreported. AARP estimates more than $28 billion is stolen due to elder fraud scams each year. They're now launching a public awareness campaign nationwide as the FBI visits senior centers, churches, and Rotary clubs.
If you've never met somebody in person, the best advice is to not send them any money.
convincing members of America's silent generation to stay vigilant and to speak out.
Just don't fall for it. Hang the phone up.
FBI officials are also urging financial institutions to create more guardrails, fraud prevention measures that would help stop seniors from transferring large sums of money to strangers. Nicole Skanga, CBS News, Washington.
It's summer out there, and what are you going to do with your kids? Health experts say getting outdoors is good for us both mentally and physically, ranging from lowering our blood pressure to helping with anxiety. But what's the use if it breaks your bank? In some places, the cost of going to camp this summer, going through the roof. CBS's Nancy Chin with tips.
When you hear summer's coming up, you think, buckle up.
For Jamie Adursky, the countdown to summer is far different than for her kids, ages 4 and 8.
These kind of juices for moms.
The New Jersey copywriter depends on camp for childcare each summer.
Wait, what?
And made this popular TikTok.
How much is camp? Oh, that's $5,000.
$5,000?
Adursky says even costs for her neighborhood rec center have become too pricey, with spots snatched up as early as January.
I've heard of people saying, I lost a job because I couldn't afford camp. It's just impossible to maintain and to, you know, be able to afford everything else we need to provide.
Why is it so competitive to get into day camp?
Every parent realizes now how important it is that kids have a summer learning program.
Tom Rosenberg heads the American Camp Association.
How much have costs gone up for camp?
Many industries are impacted by inflation, and camp is no exception.
Rosenberg says if needed, parents should ask about financial aid, which many camps provide, along with payment plans. There's also the Child and Dependent Care Tax Credit, which could offset up to $3,000 of summer camp costs per child. This year, Adursky says she's enrolling her son in a science camp, but keeping it mostly to half days spread throughout the summer.
Seeing him come home and being excited about something and learning something new, that is, of course, the ultimate goal for any parent. Camp can be a huge part of that experience. I just wish that there were more options for everybody.
Keeping camp a staple of the season for all. Nancy Chen, CBS News, New York.
She's known for her glamour, but one A-list celebrity is out there pushing for a bill to boost menopause care.
I'm in menopause!
That's actress Halle Berry.
I'm here as a citizen of the United States, as a woman who is demanding that our government give us what we need.
She joined congressional leaders as they unveiled the $275 million bill.
It has to be destigmatized. The shame has to be taken out of menopause. We have to talk about this very normal part of our life that happens.
The bipartisan legislation aims to boost federal research, physician training, and public awareness. Stacey Lynn, CBS News, Washington.
Coming up, hostages and famine.
What is the best way to get the hostages out?
That's next on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Allison Keyes. Now to the Middle East, where the Hostages Forum says a 49-year-old Israeli man held since the Hamas terror attack on October 7th has been confirmed dead. He and two of his three children were kidnapped, and his wife was killed. The BBC's Frank Gardner with more.
It's a really tragic story. I mean, all the hostage stories are tragic. This one is particularly so because their children are orphans now. They've got teenage children. Two of those were let out in November. And this kind of really brings into focus the question of what is the best way to get the hostages out? Now, every night here in Jerusalem, I drive past quite large numbers of relatives of the hostages, all holding up placards, signs saying, bring them home. They don't think that military pressure is working. They want a deal. But the hardline right-wingers in the government here are saying no deal or we leave the government, we will walk. They want to see a big military attack on Rafah, whereas wiser heads have said that is a pretty sure way to kill the remaining hostages.
This as an Israeli strike in Rafah Friday killed seven people, mostly children. Turkey has suspended all imports and exports to Israel. CBS's Remy Innocencio with more.
After Friday's prayers, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan
said that his government just couldn't keep standing by and watching what he called Israeli bombardment of defenseless, his quote, Palestinians. Now, in response, Israel's foreign minister here criticized the move and said that it breaks international trade pacts, and he even called Erdogan a dictator. Turkey says it won't restart trade, though, until a ceasefire is agreed on.
The U.S. says it will have arrangements in Gaza ready to start delivering aid this month via a new U.S.-backed sea route. But Queen Rania al-Abdullah in Jordan, who is Palestinian, says the U.S. is sending mixed messages.
On the one hand, the U.S. is demanding that more aid rightfully go back into Gaza. At the same time, they're denying that the starvation is intentional. There's an expression of concern over civilian deaths, but at the same time, there's a provision of offensive weapons.
Worries about security threats in the U.S.
The heads of the U.S. intelligence agencies appeared on Capitol Hill and told lawmakers China, Russia, and Iran are increasingly working together against American interests.
China is working to develop its own form of multilateralism while deepening its relationship with Russia and Iran in particular.
Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, testified that China and Russia are making preparations for cyber attacks on the U.S. in case there is a war with America.
Both China and Russia effectively trying to pre-position themselves in ways that would allow them to conduct those kinds of attacks.
She said the vulnerabilities could, in most cases, be easily prevented.
And in virtually all of the attacks we've seen against U.S. critical infrastructure, cyber actors took advantage of default or weak passwords, unpatched known vulnerabilities, and poorly secured network connections to launch relatively simple attacks.
The intelligence chiefs say Iran is taking advantage of Israel's war with Hamas to expand its influence throughout the Middle East.
How the current conflict between Hamas and Israel is resolved is likely to determine regional dynamics for decades.
While Israel's war with Hamas has stirred tensions around the world, the intelligence chiefs say the college protests happening around the country aren't being stoked by misinformation on the internet, at least not yet.
I would expect other countries to take advantage of the opportunity and use it as part of influence operations, but we'll continue to monitor that.
They say disinformation campaigns centered around the presidential election are in full swing. Skylar Henry, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
That buzzing you may be hearing isn't all in your head, especially in the South, and some folk are really bugging out.
It all gets started just after sunset when they emerge from the earth where they've lived for 13 years.
They don't even have working wings till they molt out of their baby bodies, where they're mature enough to fly off.
The southern soil just reached the trigger temperature of 64 degrees Fahrenheit.
Where's the sound actually coming from? It's hard to pinpoint.
It really is. It's kind of an ambient sound. They go to the top of the tree, and that's kind of where they do their mating ritual.
The eggs then drop back down here, a cycle that happens every 13 years. But this year is special.
I think I got one.
In central Illinois, Dr. Katie Dana and her son are waiting on the 17-year brood.
It's a boy.
And the 13-year ones, all in the same area, overlapping for the first time since 1803, when Thomas Jefferson was president.
And you can see other kinds of cicadas.
And those ones are still here in Urbana at the massive bug collection at the University of Illinois.
These specimens are from the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great grandparents.
We could talk about a trillion of these critters.
It's a big number, isn't it?
Yeah.
All this waiting and emerging and molting.
How was he able to jump on me if he doesn't even have wings yet?
Got rid of that baby body and flew home.
And freaking out the neighbors will come to an end about 2 weeks after they pop out of their shells. That is, if they make it to the treetops.
Everything eats these things.
This may actually be bad news for fishermen because with all the cicadas dropping in the lake here, the fish may already be full and not biting. Dave Malkoff, CBS News, Lincoln County, Georgia.
A bionic beauty is taking a California eatery by storm.
At the Cajun Kraken Seafood Restaurant just east of San Francisco, something's cooking. And not just in the kitchen.
We walked in and we saw it moving around. It was very exciting to see.
I am leaving for delivery.
Meet Rosie the Robot. She's been working here for the last 2 months now, and she's already a favorite among customers.
Rosie's cute. I like Rosie.
Very futuristic.
That's kind of crazy.
Waitress Michelle Magno says from the moment Rosie was powered up,
I am leaving for delivery.
Not only has the service gotten better, so have the tips.
People are excited to see her. A lot of my customers call her by Rosie now.
Rosie delivers food, picks up dirty dishes, and runs promotions on her screen. She can't actually take orders, at least not yet.
I am Rosie.
The best part, she's never sick, she's always on time, and for the most part, doesn't have an attitude.
The meal you ordered has arrived.
Officially called Lucky, she got her nickname Rosie because she reminded customers of another futuristic robot.
Rosie, you are worth your weight in leftovers.
Thank you.
Seen as a solution to the industry's labor shortage, server robots are becoming increasingly popular, with tens of thousands gliding through restaurants across the nation.
I am Rosie.
And although they can do a lot, there is at least one thing they can't do.
A lot of people still need, like, that human interaction.
Welcome to our restaurant.
And while it may be hard for some people to digest, Rosie the robot is here to stay. Just don't push her buttons.
Now leave me alone. I have work to do.
Itai Hot, CBS News, Concord, California.
Coming up in the Kaleidoscope with Allison Keyes segment, free speech and college protests. That's next on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Welcome to the Kaleidoscope with Allison Keyes segment, where each week we discuss issues including gender. This time we're going deeper into the protest, roaring through colleges and universities across the nation with demonstrators squaring off over the Israel-Hamas war. Some want their schools to divest any assets involving Israel, saying it is committing genocide in Gaza. Others strongly support Israel, calling any criticism of that nation anti-Semitic. We reached out to the nonprofit Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression that started out defending free speech on college campuses, but now has expanded into off-campus advocacy, and asked Executive Vice President Nico Perino to react to what's happening.
The challenge is that protests on different campuses are different. And in some cases, you have totally peaceful protesters exercising their rights, not violating any content-neutral time, place, and manner restrictions. And in those cases, the colleges and universities and the police need to give these students their First Amendment free speech rights and not shut down their protest. In other cases, you have students and others engaging willfully in civil disobedience. And in other cases, you have violence. And one of the challenges right now when we're in this polarized, tense environment is that people want to paint with a broad brush all of the protests. And as a rights-protecting organization that tries to come to the defense of people when their rights are violated, we need to look closely at the facts in any given campus. And on many occasions, we've found that the story, once we look into it, is more complicated than is initially reported or than a video might suggest on Twitter.
What do you mean?
Well, you'll see videos clipped up, for example, of certain protests that might suggest one thing, but really demonstrate something else. For example, there was one gentleman carrying around a sign who appears to push a protester over. But the video is clipped up in a way that you don't see what immediately preceded that, which was a woman come up behind him, grab his poster, and jostle with him, trying to get him to give it up. And during that jostling, she gets pushed over. So you kind of miss the context, and so you can get this sort of disinformation effect based on who on what side is trying to portray the situation one way or the other.
I've got to ask, I know that you support free speech for everyone, students, faculty, the general public. Do you think the points of view of both sides here, both pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian, are being heard here?
you know, it's not really the job of a civil liberties organization to do anything other than to defend the rights of folks on all sides of an issue to speak out and to ensure that their First Amendment free speech rights are protected and to ensure that the right to assemble is protected. Nobody has the right to an audience, but everyone has the right to speak. And groups get creative in different ways to try and ensure that their message is heard. Sometimes that they use civil disobedience, which has a long and, you know, very storied history in America. But in those cases, you have to also recognize what civil disobedience means, which means you can be punished. You can be arrested. But to the extent students and faculty are engaged in peaceful protest, the arrests or disproportionate police presence to chill the protected speech is not appropriate.
I know that you have said that schools generally handle free speech issues badly. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, colleges and universities for a decade now have been handling free speech issues poorly. They censor too often. They violate the academic freedom rights of their faculty on regular occasions. And they've lost the sense of what their institutions are for, which is for the discovery, preservation, and dissemination of knowledge. And knowledge can only be acquired, can only be pursued in an environment where students and faculty have wide latitude, as Yale puts it, to think the unthinkable, challenge the unchallengeable, and mention the unmentionable. But over the years, what we found is that colleges and universities get a little bit queasy when they have dissenters on their campus, when they challenge too much, or when they, you know, mention something that, you know, doesn't jive with the overall orthodoxy on campus. So colleges and universities would do well to get out of the speech policing business and have a wide latitude for people to engage in dialogue and dissent on their campuses, but have very little or no tolerance for violence or disruptions that interrupt the intellectual mission of the university and the enforcement of content-neutral time, place, and manner restrictions.
You said there's a long history. There are some people that have been saying that these campus protests are like the demonstrations against apartheid in South Africa and the Vietnam War. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, throughout American history, we've had flare-ups on college campuses. So to that extent, what's happening now is nothing new. Hamilton Hall on Columbia University's campus has been occupied on two or three occasions before. For example, in the 1960s, there was an occasion in the 1980s, and there was an occasion in the 1990s as well. That doesn't give college students, though, a pass to engage in civil disobedience. That doesn't mean that they can't get punished when they do it again. You have no right to take over a building or block the access to the college or university. And so if you engage in civil disobedience and you might think your cause is just and righteous, and in that case, maybe, you know, the civil disobedience is justified, but you have to accept the consequences. And the power of civil disobedience often comes from accepting the consequences of being to putting your conviction on the line and risking arrest.
I'm curious. You said that schools have historically handled the free speech issue badly. What do you think about politicians? President Biden didn't speak about this until Thursday, in which mm-hmm. he basically said that vandalism, hate speech, and other chaos should have no part in peaceful demonstrations. But a Republican senator basically compared the demonstrations to Little Gaza and accused all of them as being Hamas supporters. I mean, that doesn't sound like people are thinking fairly, does it?
One of the things that you see when you're a civil liberties organization is that political involvement in defending rights on campus isn't always helpful. They will often browbeat, as we saw in December, or most recently with the president of Columbia, college and university administrators into censoring speech that should be protected by the First Amendment. And politicians have a duty to protect the First Amendment. It's a restriction on what speech the federal government and other government officials, it's a restriction on government officials' ability to censor speech. So anytime you get politicians involved and trying to browbeat administrators into censoring on their campuses, you have to get worried. And I think we've seen that play out in this situation as well.
What about the argument that students are afraid? And I frankly heard students on almost every campus say people on both sides of this issue are afraid and feel threatened. Is there some sort of lines to cross between protecting a person's right to free speech and keeping them safe and from feeling afraid?
Well, to the extent that people are engaged in protected protest and protected assembly and expressing their minds, even in vehement or offensive language, that's just the risks of democracy. You are going to have to go through life in our democracy hearing things you don't like. The alternative is worse. The alternative is a sort of authoritarianism that doesn't let people be who they are and to speak their minds. But to the extent students are being restricted from accessing open areas of the campus based on their identity or their beliefs, that's illiberal. It's also unlawful, and colleges and universities cannot tolerate it. No student should be denied access to their campus because of their identity or beliefs. At the same time, if protesters are going to engage in civil disobedience, and as we saw at Columbia, you had protesters tell reporters, "We will not be moved unless by force," the default situation can't then just be that the protesters get to then own Hamilton Hall. There will be some use of force that police will have to use to regain control of that building, but force should be a last resort. There should be plenty of notice to the protesters to leave the building voluntarily. But in the end, and we were fortunate to see that in Columbia, it didn't appear that it devolved into any violence, and that they were able to free Hamilton Hall to be accessed again without any sort of major conflict.
So just so anyone listening who is involved in these protests or considering being involved, student, faculty, what should you do and what shouldn't you do to keep you and those you agree or disagree with safe?
Students or faculty who are participating in these protests should first and foremost know their rights. Know that the First Amendment on public university campuses protects their right to free speech and to free assembly. On private college campuses, most private college campuses have policies that protect free speech and assembly. The colleges can voluntarily restrict your right to assemble on those campuses, so you should be aware of what your rights are. And you should also recognize that violence is the antithesis of speech, and a liberal democratic society needs to have wide tolerance for expression and opinion and no tolerance for violence. Sigmund Freud once said that civilization was founded the day man first cast a word instead of a stone. That's what democracy requires. That's how we talk across lines of difference to create policy and find compromise. They should also recognize that civil disobedience comes with consequences or could come with consequences and be willing to accept that if they're not going to take notice from their college university administration or the police to vacate an area of campus, including a building that they are unlawfully occupying. So they should be aware of their rights and where those rights cross the line into civil disobedience or violence.
That's Nico Perino at the advocacy group FIRE. Coming up, confrontational climate activist. That's next on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Allison Keyes, and our latest installment of Climate Watch activists are taking bold measures.
Blocking traffic, throwing red powder on a case housing the U.S. Constitution, and dousing a glass-covered Van Gogh with soup. Climate protesters are not just marching in the streets. They're finding new and more aggressive ways to demand climate action.
We can still cause a little bit of a scene, cause some chaos.
On a recent Wednesday night in Washington, D.C.,
I know exactly the route that we can go.
21-year-old Maxwell Downing shared his plan to cause a scene at this nearby hotel.
What exactly are you guys doing tonight?
We're going to a fancy schmancy gala that J.D. Vance, Republican senator from Ohio, is going to be speaking at. J.D. Vance is one of the top 20 recipients of oil and gas money in Congress.
Downing cased the hotel the day before to find the best escape routes.
Who does not have $50 in cash?
So after making sure that everyone had money in case they got arrested,
J.D. Vance is a quiet supervillain.
These climate protesters stormed the ballroom. Interrupting the event until security finally threw them out.
Get out.
Immediately, security guards, hands around the neck, which is not usual.
They belong to a group called Climate Defiance.
You need to act.
Which says it won't engage in vandalism or violence. But has quickly become notorious for surprise confrontations with oil executives and politicians on both sides of the aisle. Senator Vance did not respond when we asked for his reaction to the disruption.
Joe Manchin.
But a recent protest of Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat, almost came to blows.
You have sold our futures and you've gotten rich doing it, you sick.
And a protester was shoved to the ground.
When you burst into a room and you call somebody like Senator Manchin a sick F-word, what is the outcome you're hoping to achieve?
We don't necessarily expect to move Manchin or whatnot. We are trying to make climate change a top issue in American politics. I mean, that reached 6 million people.
Fossil fuels, man.
Michael Greenberg is executive director of Climate Defiance.
And fossil fuels.
He says their protests are designed to go viral on social media, attracting new members to their cause and raising awareness of climate change as an existential issue.
We're going to die. Who cares how rude we are?
I don't mind if you die. We're trying to shake the public awake.
Do you worry about turning people off, that they see you as more annoying or more of a threat than actually helping the cause you say you're trying to help?
Yeah, we're definitely an acquired taste. Not everybody loves us. You don't need to be popular to be effective.
And their goal is media attention, plain and simple. He doesn't look at the general population.
Dana Fisher is a professor at American University and author of a new book about climate activism.
He's a criminal!
She calls these kinds of activists shockers, not unlike some of the AIDS activists of the 1980s who desperately tried to get people's attention.
How do we know if this is actually effective?
I think it's going to be a hindsight thing. I mean, well, I do not think that the whole movement should shift towards these kinds of actions because I think it'll be a detriment to the movement itself. But it is playing a role in helping to keep the conversation going. There's a lot of climate doom that goes around right now. Oh, you can't do anything. Well, we're doing something. We're confronting directly the people who are selling our futures.
And they have had some success. After targeting several Biden administration officials, Climate Defiance got a meeting with John Podesta, the White House's chief climate advisor. The group was also part of the pressure campaign that recently led President Biden to pause the expansion of liquefied natural gas exports.
CBS's Ben Tracy. Can music help fight Parkinson's?
Keeping to the beat of life can be a struggle, especially with Parkinson's. But these patients are finding a new rhythm with samba.
When you hear samba band in the street, you know, you can't help but going to do it. You know?
Adewyn Mallon founded the samba band Sparky in Wales to help herself and other Brits battle a disease with no cure.
You wait ages for somebody to come along and wave a magic wand, but if it's something you can do yourself, then that's really, to me, that's really important.
Parkinson's is a degenerative disease that affects the body's movement and can lead to dementia. In 2013, a doctor told Ken Howard he had just a few good years left.
I thought to myself, nobody tells me what to do like that. So that was about 11 years ago.
Scientists want to help more people live better. Over the past year, samba drummers reported improved mood and movement, but researchers want clinical evidence the music eases symptoms.
And that is one of the reasons that we're doing the trial, trying to tease out those complex mechanisms and understanding is actually the drumming itself.
Brian Dew says he doesn't need a scientist to tell him what he already knows.
But I think without samba, I think I would be struggling.
But researchers believe their year-long study could be instrumental in treating Parkinson's patients in the future. Ian Lee, CBS News, London.
Finally, a New York City museum is inviting visitors to play, pose, or be pensive with colorful concrete blocks.
Borj Terbeit.
What does that mean in English?
It's the Tower of Four.
French-Moroccan artist Ito Barada has transformed the outdoor courtyard at MoMA PS1 in Queens into an oversized playground with four massive sculptures made of green, orange, yellow, purple, brown, and bright blue blocks.
This one is Tzkel, the weight. For a long time, I thought this was the flower. That's why it has iris colors.
They're nestled inside concrete barriers of an old schoolyard.
The idea comes from the place, the space, the holes in the wall, the cement wall. The fact that my first reflex when we saw the wall is to see on the other side of the wall and see what's behind. You know, like children help each other climb over walls, the ladder that you can make with your fingers.
She didn't stop there.
Then it progressed into looking on the other side, peeking, trespassing, pushing down walls.
For Ito, it not only evokes themes of world conflict, but harkens back to Moroccan cultural history.
There's this 15th, 16th century mystic tradition of acrobats that do human pyramids, and it started as warriors to defend walls. So they would climb on top of each other. And then over time, it became a form of spiritual elevation. And in the 1800s, the descendants were brought to America in circuses and entertainment and fairs.
What better place to honor them than the New York borough that hosted the 1939 and 1964 World Fairs? A museum visitor had a hearty round of applause. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Deborah Rodriguez.
That's it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your thoughts and story ideas to weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. Sarah Fishman is a technical supervisor, and Alan Pang provides production assistance. Have a great week. I'm Allison Key, CBS News.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert. And I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
And how long have you been the producer of this?
We've been doing this for 2 years now.
Okay. And what is it like to attempt to get feedback from me about the podcast? Be honest about how quickly I respond to emails.
You actually respond to emails surprisingly fast.
Really? I think you might be the only person I respond to. Respond too quickly. Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
I expected you to lay into me.
Well, this was over the strike period.
Oh, I had time.
Yeah.
See, that doesn't count. Sure, I responded to everything because responding to you putting reruns up on the podcast was like a form of employment.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had something to get up for every day. So thank you for that. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.